from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, what we've put in place is something that is workable, something that the vast majority of people are going to be following. And I know that there are people who are attempting to challenge these things in court. I would just say that this is a very unhelpful thing to do, and it is going to make schools and healthcare settings less safe.
By definition, this is tyranny. The courts have been protecting you for the last month, saying that your due process rights cannot be violated under the law. That exclusion from school, putting masks on your babies, sticking a needle in your damn arm, or sticking a swab up your nose. You know what these useless bastards have done? The Illinois Department of Public Health just created an emergency rule. You didn't hear about it on TV. You didn't hear the governor talk about it. They are trying to, by a rule, take all of your constitutional due process rights away from you.
That's the attorney Tom DeVore in a Facebook video talking about Governor J.B. Pritzker's changes to emergency rules. DeVore has been a frequent critic of the mask and vaccine requirements the governor has put in place during the pandemic. The state's mandate for teachers, college students, healthcare workers to get vaccinated against COVID-19 or face regular testing, that's gone into effect, but a lot of people still not on board. And how is the state doing in its fight against the coronavirus? We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and he's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also joining us, Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor. And with us today, Brendan Moore. He is a state government reporter for Lee Enterprises. Brendan, thanks for being with us once again.
I was happy to be on.
Well, a few weeks back, the governor announced this vaccine requirement for school staff, college faculty, staff and students, those who work in healthcare. Hannah, it got pushed back a little bit. Now it's in place. And basically walk us through, if you don't get the vaccine, you've got to submit to regular testing. Is that pretty much what this is about?
That's right. You're supposed to submit to testing at least once a week. But how that testing is supposed to work is kind of a mixed bag, depending on where you're at in the state. At the same time, the governor announced his vaccine mandate for teachers and, like you said, healthcare workers, higher ed personnel, and students. The governor also made available to all school districts funding for shield testing, which is that quick saliva test that was developed at the University of Illinois, and that is pretty darn accurate, and that we, in fact, had to do at the Capitol all spring. But the thing about that testing is not all schools have signed up. Maybe about half, a little bit over half the districts in Illinois have signed up, but just a small fraction of those have actually started to implement that testing because there is just a shortage of people to do the tests. And a Tribune story that was published last week cited lack of communication between Shield and the district. So it's kind of been a cluster in the rollout. And if teachers don't have access to that in their buildings, then they're kind of responsible for going to get tested elsewhere, going to a Walgreens, for example, or their local health department. And in rules that were published by ISBE, the State Board of Education, this week, I read that it's not necessarily, it's kind of up to districts whether or not they want to reimburse their teachers for that testing. But interestingly, school districts can't use their Federal CARES Act money to reimburse teachers. So again, a mixed bag, and we're definitely seeing some opposition still. And that's where people like Tom DeVore, the ever-present anti-COVID restriction attorney, who, by the way, is also running for appellate court in the 4th District, that's where he comes in. And he's got a number of cases from teachers filed in a lot of downstate regions. And so I'm sure we'll talk about the legal reasoning behind that and what might happen there. But you know, this is not a done deal. Yes, the state's two largest education or teachers unions supported the vaccine mandate, but it has not been necessarily smooth sailing. Yeah,
Brendan, I'm a little surprised by that. Not that you're not going to have some bumps along the way. Anything this large is going to have some problems. But this, it seems to me the state was probably thinking this could very well happen, you know, months ago. That to get schools back in, you're going to have to undergo this testing. And of course, they push back the deadline, for a few more weeks, and finally now in effect. It just seems to me like not having the ducks in a row is a little surprising.
Yes, it is a bit surprising. Especially so late in the pandemic, we're more than 18 months into this. When the state was caught flat-footed in March 2020, it could be maybe a little bit more understandable. But obviously, they had a lot of time to plan for this. They had the summer to plan for this. Even with the kind of slow rollout from the state, you're still seeing a lot of hesitancy from teachers and from staff. To actually go and get vaccinated, which adds to the problem and adds to the amount of testing that needs to be done. It'll be interesting to see how it goes moving forward.
You know, at least I can understand in their mind why they might not want to get the vaccine. Maybe they don't trust it, whatever. But the testing seems rather odd to me. As somebody who's had to undergo this testing as part of the University of Illinois, it's painless. You go, you spit in a tube, and basically they send you back results in a pretty short time frame. So that seems like a pretty good compromise for those that don't want to get the vaccine.
To get back to what was mentioned earlier in terms of the slow rollout, the Trip story suggested that part of it was a lot of school districts waited to the last minute to sign up for the program, and the people supplying the materials kind of got caught flat-footed too. I think that's a problem that's going to resolve itself going forward. But in terms of resisting the test, DeVore used the thing, you don't want somebody sticking something up your nose. Well, as a matter of fact, you don't have to. All you got to do is drool into a test tube. That doesn't strike me as being very invasive. It strikes me as being a kind of a common sense approach, that if for whatever reason you don't want to get the vaccine, okay, but let's make sure that you're not spreading this potentially fatal disease to people you come in contact with, particularly in elementary schools, because those kids are still too young to be vaccinated, and they can become ill. Now, people say, well, they don't get that seriously ill and very few of them die. But I'm thinking, if you can prevent one little kid from dying, why the heck wouldn't you do that?
One school district, a small district in western Illinois, Nauvoo Coosa, this week made some news, choosing to exempt some unvaccinated staff from COVID testing. The school district decided there were at least about a dozen or so teachers who had come forward and said they did not want to be tested. And they brought forth a case saying that it was discrimination in their mind because not everyone has to be tested. Hannah, is there concern at the state level over that this could somehow disrupt this entire idea of monitoring, testing, and even vaccinating teachers?
Well, so as I understand it, and by the way, this district, I believe, is also on probation for not enforcing the governor's mask mandate in schools. But I believe the legal underpinnings of the case are that, by being forced to also test because I'm unvaccinated, that is, like you said, discrimination under the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act, which is this decades-old law that was kind of designed to shield doctors, nurses, healthcare providers from having to, provide abortions or, you know, anything like that. And so it's kind of an interesting, novel attempt to use this law for something, you know, clearly the drafters of this law way back in the 1970s never really intended for. I think that ultimately when the case, if a local judge were to go with that, I think it would be overturned on appeal. But it's still an interesting, you know, what would happen in the meantime if, you know, if teachers were just allowed to not test at all because of this, because a local judge sided with the teachers. You know, would other districts cave to the pressure? Would they replicate it? Would it be, you know, chaos for about a month? Possibly. And then the, you know, the thing that would kind of have to happen legally is the legislature would have to step in and adjust that old law to say, you know, for example, if it's not applicable during a pandemic, or, you know, tighten it up, tighten up the broad language there. I'm not sure that one, that will happen, or that it will need to happen, but two, if it did need to happen, I'm not sure how willing the legislature would necessarily be to go along with that, because, you know, it's kind of, it's a little bit forgotten at this point, but there was a lot of enmity between the legislature and the governor, even Democrats in the legislature, for the governor's kind of go it alone strategy, using his power of executive authority to put in place all of these COVID restrictions while the legislature was not meeting. And yeah, I don't know that they would necessarily be willing to stick their neck out politically, because they've complained in the past, but they've also kind of enjoyed the political cover. I'm not sure if enjoyed is necessarily the right word, but like in terms of they've been able to not have to, like I said, stick their neck out. So yeah, it's, like I said, a novel legal argument, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes. But, you know, just another in the pile of cases and interesting legal theories brought by Tom DeVore.
Yeah, Charlie, you've read this law. You went back, in fact, just the last day or so and took a look back through it, and get your thoughts on how this is being applied in this argument that's being made regarding it.
Yeah, and actually, this law was first enacted back in 1977 in the wake of the Roe v. Wade decision in 73, and I wrote about it for the Sun Times at the time, and I can't quote you exactly what I wrote, but the object was, as was indicated, was to protect healthcare providers, doctors, hospitals, particularly Catholic ones, that did not want to have to provide abortion services. And so it was drafted with that in mind, and it began speaking of the Right of Conscience Act, and some 20 years later, it was amended to say the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act. But the argument is that, well, this clearly says that if I have some conscientious objection, you can't force me to take a test. And as I read the law, I'm not sure that's clear, because the very first section of the law talks about definitions. And healthcare is defined as saying it means any phase of patient care. Does me being asked to drool in a test tube, does that constitute patient care? I'm thinking if I were a judge, reasonable, rational guy, I'd say, no, that's not patient care, for heaven's sake, and throw out the suits. And I might add, as a snotty aside, probably the only guy who's got worse record on his suits is Donald Trump.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Brendan Morris with Lee Enterprises. Brendan, as we keep hearing about teachers and healthcare workers, the governor has also been pretty adamant that he wants to see those state workers who are in, you know, work in these congregate settings, veterans' homes, mental health facilities, you know, prisons, places like that, that they need to be vaccinated as well. What's going on with that? Because well, this vaccine mandate with the teachers and others has taken effect. The governor's office still trying to work something out with the AFSCME union. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So, earlier this week there was an agreement with a smaller union. I believe it was with some guards at some congressional facilities. Anna, correct me if I'm a little bit wrong on that, but most of the unions that the governor is still negotiating with AFSCME, and which has shown some hesitancy, I guess would be a generous term, towards vaccine mandates. They're actually opposed to mandated vaccination. If you look at some of the facilities where they have members, especially some of these downstate correctional facilities, the vaccination numbers are incredibly low. Some in the teens and 20%. So there's a real uphill battle to get a lot of these facilities vaccinated or mandate vaccination, and to get the unions to agree with it. The governor believes that with that agreement with that smaller union, that might be a model, but I think it's probably going to be a more of an uphill climb than they would hope.
Yeah, and Brendan, I think it's clear that AFSCME believes this needs to be bargained, this issue, and there has been some question about that, but at this point, that's the route the governor's office is taking, correct?
Right, and obviously this governor got elected as a friend of labor. He's had the support of unions for most of his governorship, and there's been, I guess, a divide amongst some of the state's major unions. Obviously, we were just talking about teachers. The two major teacher unions in the state have supported vaccine mandates for their members. But obviously, the politics are a bit different with AFSCME, which represents a lot of members downstate in areas that you have very low vaccination rates and where there's still a lot of vaccine hesitancy. So that'll be, if the governor continues to stick with that, I guess, this route of trying to negotiate with the unions, it might be a while before progress can be made on getting those mandates in and getting vaccination rates up in a lot of these facilities.
Before we leave this topic, Hannah, I did want to go back to the attorney, Tom DeVore, which we'd mentioned. He has fought a lot of these pandemic-related actions from the governor and public health. He's still keeping that fight up. Has he had some success in some court jurisdictions? I mean, I think he's had some judges go along with him later. The rulings have gotten overturned, but has he had any more recent success?
Yeah, I believe we talked last week or the week before about two cases in the 4th District. I think one was in Clinton County, the other in Effingham County, and those had to do with the mask mandate. Again, likely overturned on appeal, but that definitely strengthens kind of the whole movement and gives more power. And, you know, the other thing that I think has been really interesting to watch is the online fundraising. Like Tom DeVore, he is the name, he is the celebrity in this space. And so there's been a ton of online fundraising from, you know, parents, especially, but also, you know, to some extent now some teachers, the parents who want to overturn the mask mandate in their individual schools for, so their children don't have to go to school with a mask on their face. That's been really interesting. So yes, a limited success, like you said, over the whole course of the pandemic, but definitely a trend upward in success lately, as we've seen, these minor victories that have spurred some more action in that arena.
So he, Charlie, again, before we leave the topic here, when it comes to Tom DeVore, but he's not the only one who has complained that the governor at times has overstepped his authority, or maybe at least that the legislature needs to step in, that the governor shouldn't be able to unilaterally make some of these types of decisions. Your thoughts on that? You followed government for a long time, and I realize it is an emergency, a public health emergency, but there has been plenty of time. The legislature's come back for many other things. Is it time for the legislature to have more of a say in some of these decisions?
I suppose you could argue that, but on the other hand, you can also, as was mentioned earlier, the governor is taking all the heat for this. And if you're a particular, and again, this is uncharitable, but if you're a particularly cowardly legislator, you're very glad. You can tell your constituents, well, it's on the governor, I'm sorry. And it, for the people who are anti-vaccine, anti-mask, you say, oh yeah, I'm with you. And then later on, the people who are in favor, you can say, well, I'm with you too. And so I think the reality is if the legislature really, really wanted to get involved, the legislative leaders, the Senate president and the Speaker of the House, have the ability together to call a special session. And if it was really that much of a concern to most of their members, they'd call a special session and say, we need to address what the governor's doing, either give him flat out clear statutory authority to do this or rein him in. But the fact that they haven't done that suggests to me that it's not that big an issue in a lot of the state, and particularly for Democrats. The loudest voices are coming from the Republicans, who are in a super minority, and God bless them, they have to figure out some way to try and make themselves appear relevant, and they have to try and raise money. That's what it's all about. And if you actually look at the statistics, there was a Fox poll that came out a week or so ago and showed overwhelming support for vaccine and mask mandates. The question, for example, about should teachers be vaccinated? 61% said yes, 36% said no. Should government workers be vaccinated? 58% yes, 40% no. And should businesses get vaxxed and tested? 56% yes. I guess you would call it the silent majority, not the ones who are doing all the screaming and shouting, think that this is a smart public health move. And again, it goes back to, if the legislature was really that concerned, they have the power to do something without the government or the governor.
One product of the pandemic has been an eviction moratorium put in place, trying to prevent people from being thrown out of their homes. It's been extended several times, but it is set to expire very soon. Brendan, you've been following this. Where does it stand at this point, and is there any chance that there might be some reprieve at the last minute?
Well, the simple answer right now is no. The governor's office yesterday confirmed that they plan to let the moratorium sunset as planned on October 3rd. As you said, Sean, it's been extended many times already, and many advocates would say those extensions have helped save thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people from being thrown out on the street, being evicted. What people will tell you is that right now it's kind of an issue of timing. So Illinois has made a significant amount of rental assistance available both last year and this year. And a lot of it's already out the door. This year alone, from the state, more than $380 million has flown to more than 41,000 applicants for aid, about 9,000 per household. But you still have about 25,000 applications that the state is trying to work through for those remaining funds. And then even beyond that, there's about $400 million in rental assistance that the state hasn't even opened yet for applicants. That'll be later this fall. So a lot of housing advocates would like to see an extension, another extension, if just for a few weeks or a month, just so more people can get money in their hands and maybe stave off some unnecessary evictions. However, if you talk to folks at the state, they will tell you that there is enough of a safety net now with the state aid, with the court-based aid program that was announced a couple of weeks ago. A lot of counties have implemented mediation programs with landlords and tenants, trying to get to work it out where you can avoid eviction. And a lot of people are concerned that October 3rd will come and you will see a flood of evictions. And obviously you talk to property owners, landlords will say it's been long enough. A lot of smaller property owners have been significantly impacted by this and are looking to get back to more of a normal way of doing things.
Okay, let's go to our notes from the field. And Hannah, let's start with you.
There is a new report out from the land of the Executive Inspector General that found the former executive director of the state's Property Tax Appeals Board. I know that was a lot of names I just spit out. Basically, the former head of this body that's supposed to kind of oversee property tax appeals in the state. He was ousted last year, and now we kind of know why. He was under investigation for what was happening related to the property tax refund for Trump Tower, for the former president's property in Chicago. What happened was, a few days after he was interviewed by Inspector General folks, he deleted a couple hundred emails, which is definitely a no-no in government.
And Brendan?
A couple of weeks ago, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability released their annual report on gaming in Illinois. And one of the key findings was that video gaming terminals in the state, raised record amounts of revenue, more than $1.93 billion. And that is despite there being a two-month gap in this fiscal year because of a COVID-related shutdown. And the previous record was fiscal year 2019, which was about $1.6 billion. So analysts at the commission say that a lot of this may be due to pent-up demand, but also due to some changes in the state gaming law from 2019 that allowed bars and restaurants to add a sixth terminal to their establishment, and also allowed maximum wagers to go up from $2 to $4.
Okay, and Charlie.
Well, the governor announced a couple of days ago that more than $40 million in workforce training grants are going to be going out to community organizations, basically to expand access to training, job placement, services that are needed to help people find employment, and to concentrate on areas that historically have been underserved. And so it's money that came from the federal government as part of the American Rescue Plan Act. And it builds on some of the job creation language that was included in the energy bill that was signed into law a few weeks ago.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Brendan Moore. He's with Lee Enterprises. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes, and join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
Been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.